You're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. That's a pretty heady description of what it means to be a follower of Christ, I think. You're chosen, you're royal, you're a priest, you're holy, you're one of God's own people. It's also a description that forms part of the acquired baggage of Western Christianity that I have more and more difficulty with as I grow older. There's a very clear taste of elitism about this description, a sense that Peter is being a little bit over-enthusiastic about the merits of being a Christian, a description that definitely sets Christians apart from the rest of humanity, and I would argue it's a description that risks setting Christians above the rest of humanity. You're chosen, you're royal, you're a priest, holy, one of God's own people, la crème de la crème. It's not a description or an attitude that I'm terribly comfortable with, if that's the way we take it. So I'd like to pick it apart a little bit and try to explore how it might be understood and embraced, but with a little bit more humility. And to do that, I decided to step back a bit and read the entire letter that Peter has written to try and put this particular passage into some kind of broader context. And I think if you do that, one of the first things that might strike you about Peter's letter is how much of his instructions to the churches are a little bit already out of step with our own understanding of what's important for faithful living. Things that we have taken to be representative of Peter's own cultural norms, rather than representative of what's required of the church at all times and in all places. Things that may chafe a little bit as we read them. And I'm thinking here specifically of things like his instructions to slaves a little bit later in chapter 2, where he tells them to, quote, accept the authority of your masters with all deference, not only those who are kind and gentle, but also those who are harsh, for it is to your credit if, being aware of God, you endure pain while suffering unjustly. I think most of us, while comfortable with the idea of turning the other cheek and enduring unjust pain, might have different advice to offer slaves. We'd certainly have different advice from the advice that Paul offers to slave owners in his letter to the Colossians, where he tells them, masters, treat your slaves justly and fairly, for you know that you also have a master in heaven. And as progressive as this may have been for Paul in Paul's time, I think we would recognize that it doesn't go quite far enough in terms of the responsibilities of people who own other people. And I'm thinking too of Peter's instructions with regard to the conduct of wives in chapter 3 of this same letter. He says, and I quote, do not adorn yourselves outwardly by braiding your hair and by wearing gold ornaments or fine clothing, but rather let your adornment be the inner self with the lasting beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in God's sight. It was in this way long ago that the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves by accepting the authority of their husbands. Thus Sarah obeyed Abraham and called him Lord. Ah, the good old days. Of course, he does temper that a little bit by his instructions to husbands immediately after that passage, where he tells them to, quote, in the same way, show consideration for your wives in your life together, paying honor to the woman as the weaker sex. Again, progressive for his time, perhaps, but I think most of us would see that it doesn't quite go far enough. But the other thing that might strike you about Peter's letter is the extent to which suffering is a subtext to his message of hope and encouragement. He's writing to the Christian diaspora, to the exiles in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia, and there's a palpable sense that things are tense. He uses the word suffering no less than 17 times in this short letter, and he makes regular reference to what must be a backdrop of very high anxiety. He even explicitly tells his readers in chapter 5 and verse 7 to, quote, cast all your anxiety on God because God cares for you. So there's definitely a sense that these believers are in danger, or at least that they're in a perilous situation. In chapter 1, verse 6, he says, in this you rejoice, even if for now, for a little while, you have had to suffer various trials. In chapter 2, verses 13 to 17, he says, for the Lord's sake, accept the authority of every human institution, whether of the emperor as supreme, or of governors as sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to praise those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing right, you should silence the ignorance of the foolish. As servants of God, live as free people, yet do not use your freedom as a pretext for evil. Honor everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God and honor the emperor. And I think this reference to the acceptance of the authority of governors and emperors is telling. These young Christian communities in the diaspora are walking a fine line, I think. And they're not alone in this. At least the people that he's writing to are not alone in this. In chapter 4, verse 12, he says, beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that is taking place among you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. And then a little bit later in chapter 5, you know that your brothers and sisters throughout the world are undergoing the same kinds of suffering. There seems to be a widespread experience of persecution or a threat of some kind. And I think Peter's explanation for this heightened sense of suffering is quite clearly found in chapter 1, verse 20. He, Jesus, he says, was destined before the foundation of the world, but was revealed at the end of the ages for your sake. And again in chapter 4, verse 7, the end of all things is near, therefore be serious and discipline yourselves for the sake of your prayers. The end of all things is near. Peter clearly believes that he and his fellow believers are living in the last days of the human story. They're awaiting Christ's imminent return and seem to take it as a given that something as portentous as this must be accompanied by major disruption and difficulty. They're in a survival mode, and Peter's trying to shore them up and encourage them as best he can. And that makes me wonder if his talk of being a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, is a way of helping them face the danger that they're in. A way of helping them take a deep breath and instilling in them a sense of purpose and meaning that will carry them through the ordeal ahead. I don't mean to suggest that he's perhaps engaging in some kind of intellectual, psychological manipulation. I'm sure he embraced the theology behind his statements. But I wonder if his underlining of this understanding of theology is a way of pumping up the troops, so to speak. I suppose it's not surprising that the early Anabaptists also saw themselves as a separate people, a royal priesthood of believers, privy to, in Peter's words from chapter 1 of his letter, privy to good news by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things into which angels long to look. In other words, custodians of an understanding of faithfulness that was sure to bring them into conflict with their own authorities and human institutions, whether of the emperor as supreme or of governors as sent by him to punish those who do wrong and praise those who do right. And they too, I suppose, held to the words of Peter to honor everyone, love the family of believers, fear God, and honor the emperor. And they believed these things, knowing that they were putting their lives at risk by living up to the standards that they believed in. Now, working with refugees and asylum seekers, victims of organized violence and torture over the years, you learn that people need to develop survival strategies that will get them through. They need strategies and a belief system that will sustain them. Something that will give them strength and hope and give them a sense of purpose and meaning. And those survival strategies have their place during times of danger and risk. These survival strategies can provide a structure and a way of understanding what's happening so that one can continue in the struggle without being crushed. And even if one ultimately loses his or her life, they can still see this not as a failure, but as a faithful seeing through of their duty or their mission, as a part of a larger struggle that is not theirs alone. Survival strategies and belief systems have a function. They protect and they shelter against the weight of oppression that threatens to destroy. They're a source of strength and a way of remaining connected to something greater than yourself, even when alone in the torture cell. But survival strategies and belief systems can become dysfunctional when the danger is no longer present or when the danger is of a different kind. They can become patterned behaviors that no longer provide protection, but rather interfere with the normal business of life. A father, for example, who needs to develop a certain level of aggression to protect his family may become habitually abusive and violent even when the need for that aggressive behavior is no longer present. A member of an opposition political party may need to develop a certain kind of circumspection when they're around individuals not a part of their movement because they don't know who they can trust. But this circumspection can turn into paranoia when they're finally in power and can in turn become violent. A religious movement whose members risk being burned at the stake or being drowned as heretics may be justified in embracing an understanding of their identity that allows them to accept this fate as part of their act of faithfulness. You're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. And I wonder, can we read that sentence as less a declaration of the special nature of an elite body than the mission and aspirational statement and rallying call of a very human, very intimate body of people who aspire to embrace the idea that all of humanity is ultimately chosen by God, that we are all of us the bearers of royal blood, that we are priests who have no special power or mystical ordination, but who do have access to the Holy of Holies along with our brothers and sisters in faith, that we are God's own people, each of us carrying God's image. That same religious movement whose members no longer risk being burned at the stake or being drowned as heretics may need to guard against an elevated sense of importance and superiority that interferes with the normal business of life, to love God with everything we have, and to love others as much as we love ourselves. Thank you.